You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Elise Perry. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024.
Later in the program, WFHB News spoke with Christina Avery and Haley Miller, two reporters from the Limestone Post magazine. Avery and Miller authored a two-part series on food insecurity for Deep Dive, WFHB and Limestone Post Investigate. More in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, what are the facts on Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment on the WFHB local news. More following today's feature, but first, your local headlines.
The Ellettsville Town Council met on April 9th. At their meeting, they discussed Starnes Road Water Project. Town Manager Mike Farmer said that the local company Core and Main won the bid for the project.
So there were three bids. Core and Main was the low bid at $133,856.50. And I don't have the other bids, but the second one is about $4,000 more. And the third one was $7,000 more than the Core and Main bid. So they were low bid. They're local. And so I would like to have that approved.
The water project, which is part of Ellettsville's 40-year town plan, will replace the current 6-inch water main that was installed in the 1950s. Farmer says the new 12-inch water main will improve the water quality in the town.
We're replacing that water main, so the water quality and fire protection will just, it'll be excellent compared to the water main. The water main that was put in is so old, it was before they put concrete liners in the pipe. So old pipes like that tubercle up, unlike what you'd see like a barnacle or something. And so it doesn't lend itself to having good water quality. So this is a big deal that we replace this water main. We've had a lot of interest for us to do this for quite a while by the residents out there.
Board member Dan Swafford asked if the town residents would notice a disruption in their water service during the project. Farmer responded that people on Starnes Road would see a disruption, but they will be notified in advance.
When we tie in and cut off the old main, there'll be a disruption to service with the people on Starnes Road. They'll be notified. I'm pretty sure we'll go through a boil water. But they'll be told what to do and when, and so everybody will get a personal notification.
The Starnes Road Water Project is set to start as soon as weather permits. The next Ellettsville Town Council meeting will take place on April 22nd.
At the April 9th meeting of the Bloomington Board of Public Works, the board members discussed change order package number 2 for the Hopewell East project. The Hopewell East project is the first step of the larger Bloomington Hospital reuse project, which aims to create a variety of housing where Bloomington's hospital used to stand. According to Senior Project Manager Roy Aiton, the change order package updates the pricing for different aspects of the project's infrastructure.
The 5 change orders that are included in the package, change order number 9, is for some additional pavement markings that were quantities that were not enough in the amount of $1,396. Change order number 10 was for an addition of $3,100, and that was for some additional demolition work that was required on the project. Change order number 12 was for some additional rock excavation for the cistern tank that was installed in the new park for an amount of $12,358. Change order 13 was for a credit of $5,200, and that was a change that we made with the stain on the seating in the park. And change order number 14 is for some changes that were required at the Centerstone Center in the amount of $2,945.44, and that was some adjustments to their downspouts.
The change order package adds $15,000 to the project total, bringing the cost to just under $13,553,000. This is the second increase to the original estimate of just under $13,373,000. Board Secretary James Roach inquired about the goal of Phase 1 of the Hopewell East project. Public Works Director Adam Wason explained that the phase focuses on the site's basic infrastructure.
More of the road, stormwater type construction activities, general site infrastructure activities, nothing to do with actual development or housing or redevelopment of any of the current buildings on the site.
The board approved the change order package unanimously. The Board of Public Works will meet again on April 23rd.
In today's feature report, WFHB News spoke with Christina Avery and Haley Miller, two reporters from the Limestone Post magazine. Avery and Miller authored a two-part series on food insecurity for Deep Dive, WFHB and Limestone Post Investigate. The story has been placed in the Indiana Society of Professional Journalists Best in Journalism competition. For more about their process and what they learned from reporting on this issue, we turn to that interview on the WFHB Local News.
We heard you had difficulty getting sources to respond to you. Do you have any idea why it was so challenging for this story in particular?
Well, I can speak about it just from the perspective of people who actually are food insecure and just say that a lot of people feel embarrassed or ashamed about not having the money to purchase food. And especially there's such a cultural bias against people who aren't able to provide for themselves or that sort of thing. So I think that there can be this social stigma around it, and people are very cognizant of that. So we tried to reach out via the Monroe County Mutual Aid page, which was, I think, the best way to reach people because it allowed them to come to us instead of messaging people and being like, hey, will you talk to me? But this, we could just make a post on the page and say, here's the story we're doing. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And that was when I got the most responses. But still, for the most part, people wanted to speak on background and then or be anonymous, but quoted in the story. So I think that it really all comes back to that level of shame that exists in our society around not being able to provide for yourself the resources that you need. And it's not right that it is that way, but it is that way.
Yeah, and social media is so useful for that. And another kind of part of why we ran into that access issue with people is we also reached out to food pantries and we asked, you know, can you get us connected to people in the community? But part of that goes back to that stigma and that shame is like, they don't want to overstep and share people's stories. You know, people have to speak for themselves and they should be allowed to speak for themselves. And at the end of the day, that's more important than any story that we could get or report. And I think in terms of reaching the food pantries, we had a little bit less of an issue with that. I think we were pretty much able to get all the people that we really set out to. But these pantries and these community resources are so overworked. Like, they don't have time always to sit down with you and have these conversations because they're out there in the world doing the work. And so that was another reason why we did struggle a little bit to get connected to people.
Like, we reached out on Reddit. Like, people were talking in the Reddit about, oh, like, where's a good place that you can get, like, a $2 meal or a $10 meal for two people? And, you know, so many people replied. So you know that there's that going on in the community. But, yeah, when we reached out to them, like, no response, just crickets.
Yeah.
And our source is really stressed that food insecurity can affect anyone. And there's no shame in using these resources. If you are in a bind, they are here for everyone in the community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can really see how that stigma has just infected every level of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Because when I was reaching out to people, I would have them tell me, like, yeah, I couldn't afford food this month, but I'm not like the other people who can't afford food and want to go on welfare. Mm-hmm. So, like, there is that them drawing that line in the sand of, this is, you know, this is an accident. It wasn't supposed to be this way. And I mean, I think that, again, is rooted in just this idea that it's a personal failing to not be able to provide food for yourself.
Yeah, it's like that level of kind of shame and struggle can put you in a little bit of denial. And then people think, you know, oh, I'm not food insecure enough. I'm not sick enough. I'm not hungry enough. And so they don't reach out to any resources because they think if, you know, well, I don't need all of them. I don't need everything. But it's like they still, at the end of the day, like they still struggle to make that rent payment at the end of the month. They still struggle to, you know, make that final week of groceries. So a lot of people don't see that they are in need because other people have it worse.
Well, and it's kind of twofold too, because while there are resources available, when we're talking to a lot of these nonprofit organizations, you know, a lot of them say, as it is with a lot of nonprofits, that they're under-resourced. So when it comes to solving immediate needs for people who are hungry, when you were talking to different food pantries, what did they tell you about how they're faring in the here and now when it comes to funding and resources and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, something I heard a lot was the recognition that they're just a Band-Aid on a much larger societal problem and feeling like, I mean, there's just only so much that they can do. So they provide a hot meal every night, but in the end, it's something that is beyond their power and control. Christy, what did you encounter with that?
Yeah, the bottom line from what I heard from the people I spoke to was kind of, you know, we're never not struggling. Like, we always could use more food. We could always use more supplies or resources or whatever it may be. And I think, like you said, it is like a governmental problem and a larger, you know, structural issue. And that's also not to say that, like, the people that work at these places aren't struggling with the same things. So I think it's just a lot of not being supported by the outside forces because, like you said, at the end of the day, there's only so much like a small community pantry can do, and they already go above and beyond.
With issues as complex as food insecurity, how do you narrow the story down and decide what to focus on?
I think that we, for the first part of this story, we focused on diagnosing the problem and determining what are the risk factors, what's the data that you need to know. And then for the second part, we were really more focused on being solutions oriented. And that's a big part of what the Limestone Post magazine does. Mm-hmm. They want to be a solutions focused outlet. So yeah, that was basically what we did for the second part. And we talked to some experts about what you can do in Bloomington and then about a universal basic income, which was something that was a major part of our story. That was something that I think a lot of experts in the first part told us about. And then we moved forward with that in the second because income is really at the heart of a lot of what we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think, you know, another way that we kind of narrowed that down was through, you know, identifying certain demographics and populations of people who were experiencing this. And obviously, like, this can hit anyone at any time, but there are, you know, certain communities who are more at risk for it because they're, you know, under-resourced and underrepresented in other ways. And so that definitely leads to a bigger risk for them and then a bigger impact too when it does happen. So we tried to talk to the most vulnerable around the state and in the community too.
And you started getting into stuff about solutions, and I wanted to pivot a little bit and kind of piggyback off of what you were saying. So in your story, you mentioned various approaches to tackling food insecurity. And just generally, I know you touched on UBI a little bit. We can touch on it a little bit more. But what are some ways as a society we can make that first step in solving an issue like hunger? I know a lot of people we talk to is like, I don't know if there's a one size fits all solution. It might be pretty multifaceted, but, you know, if we had a big lofty goal of eliminating hunger, what's that first step look like?
Well, I mean, one is just moving beyond a network of very conflicting, like sometimes contradictory systems that really are allowing a lot of people to fall through the cracks into a system that maybe works together and addresses a lot of problems at once. A part of that, like, could be universal basic income, as we touched on before. But I think that Christy did a lot of reporting on the changes that could be made to the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program.
Yeah.
If you want to touch on that as well.
Yeah, totally. There are a lot of things with SNAP, you know, and we think of SNAP traditionally as, you know, a really good thing. And it is a really helpful thing for a lot of people. But there are certain, I guess, you know, things in the application and things in the forms you have to fill out where you know, you get cut off if you're at a certain level of income. And I think the biggest thing is a lot of, you know, people who are in middle class or lower middle class fall through those cracks because, you know, they make enough to live, but they don't make enough to, you know, qualify for SNAP assistance. But they're still struggling every day to, you know, buy food or buy, you know, household goods or whatever it may be. And then there are also things, you know, cutoffs for people on disability. So it's just like there's a lot of, I guess, like really unexpected problems that you can run into that affect people in a wide range of communities and with a wide range of, you know, problems that they're dealing with. And so people might think, oh, it's so easy, you know, just get on food stamps. But it's not that easy in reality for most people. And not everybody also gets the same level of food stamps. So, you know, you may not get enough to cover all that you need. You may not get enough to, if you have certain health conditions like diabetes, you may not get enough to, you know, buy the specific foods you need. So it's things like that that really make it hard to, you know, not only find those resources, but actually use them.
Yeah. And I saw the issues with SNAP play out very personally with Jessica, who was our main source for this story.
Yeah.
She was part of a dual income household. And between her and her partner, there were three jobs being worked, and it still wasn't enough to cover meals every month. You know, most of the time they were okay, but like you mentioned earlier, one thing that was unexpected, one unexpected event was enough to send them over the edge for the month. That's really all that it takes. And you can have that impacting someone who, you know, in our traditional idea of middle class America should be okay, but she's not.
That was an interview with Christina Avery and Haley Miller, two reporters from the Limestone Post magazine who authored a two-part series on food insecurity. Visit WFHB.org to read the full articles and listen to the accompanying radio segments on food insecurity for Deep Dive, WFHB and Limestone Post Investigate.
Up next, what are the facts on Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment on the WFHB local news. We turn to host and producer Richard Fish for more.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Well, how do you tell? I mean, how do you know for sure? How do you ever really know?
The Fireside Theater, as usual, could not have said it better. We're always trying to figure out what the truth is, especially when we have to make choices or make decisions. Of course, the best way is to do your own research. Find the facts, look at them, and then make up your own mind. That's the best way, all right. But it is extra trouble, and it can take a lot of time. It's a whole lot faster and easier to just latch on to someone else's opinion, which can be very dangerous if you trust the wrong person. But we all do it, and opinions can be useful if, and it's a big if they meet two criteria. First, opinions should come from someone you know personally, well enough to know how trustworthy they are. Opinions from anyone you've never met should be taken with a grain of salt, unless you check them by finding the facts yourself. And second, those views should be theirs, based on that person's own experience, not something that happened to or was said by someone else. Suppose you want to find a contractor to fix your roof, and you ask some friends. One says, "I hired Bill Smith, and he did a great job." Another says, "I hired Joe Jones, and he did a lousy job." And a third says, I heard Joe Jones was pretty good. Who you gonna call? Online, expert tests and reviews can offer opinions, but the good ones also offer facts, facts based on their own direct experience. You can tell what they think is important, even though you never met the reviewer. Consumer reviews, opinions, are all over the internet these days, and there are websites like Yelp and Angie's List, which specialize in offering you lots of opinions about products and places from people you don't know. Get out your salt shaker for those. All too many are fakes, planted by people who stand to make money on the deal. Sometimes, though, you have to choose among opinions. You have to check what they say against what is known for certain. That can easily be even harder and riskier than forming your own opinions. As author Robert Heinlein put it, quote, "What are the facts? Again and again and again, what are the facts? Shun wishful thinking. Ignore divine revelation. Forget what the stars foretell. Avoid opinion. Care not what the neighbors think. Never mind the unguessable verdict of history. What are the facts, and to how many decimal places? You pilot always into an unknown future. Facts are your single clue. Get the facts." End of quotation. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break. This is In Nature.
This is Juliana Daly with In Nature, and today I am talking to you about the Indiana bat. The Indiana bat is a medium-sized mouse-eared bat native to North America. It lives primarily in southern and midwestern states and is listed as an endangered species. The Indiana bat is gray-black or chestnut in color and is between 1 and 2 inches long. The 2019 winter census estimate of the population was 537,297 bats occurring in 16 states. The current population has declined by half compared to when the species was listed as endangered. The reason it is endangered is due to human disturbance of caves that bats use for winter hibernating. Loss of summer habitat, pesticides, and the white nose syndrome disease are other reasons they are declining. Bats are fascinating creatures. They are the only mammal capable of true flight, and they use sonar or echolocation to navigate through their environment and capture prey. All Indiana bats are insectivores, which means they eat insects. Although bats may be helpful to humans by consuming insects, some bats are infected with rabies and can transmit the disease to humans by biting, scratching, or through saliva contact. In the evening, bats emerge from their caves and flit through the air, diving for insects. They do make a soft chirp or clicking sound while hunting.
You've been listening to In Nature, a production of WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Support for the WFHB local news is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. More information online at mpisolar.com. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Elise Perry in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Cade Young and Noel Herhusky-Schneider.
Better Beware is produced by Richard Fish. Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Elise Perry.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast online at WFHB.org.
The WFHB Local News is also available as a podcast. Just search our call letters, WFHB, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribe to never miss another local news program.
Stay tuned for Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio, coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news at WFHB.org. You can become a WFHB Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB Local News Archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB Local News. We are local, longer,